from the Community Center for Urban Research and Education. My name is Paul Dragowski. I'm the director of that center, and also the Urban Studies Program here, which is headed by Laura Manidi, who is there. And I also want to thank Laurie for reaching out today to our guest, and I want to thank Natasha Tersey for... why don't you wave, Natasha?
Hi.
I see some new faces here, so if you heard about this secondhand and you didn't get an email about it and you want to hear about future events in this seminar series, talk to Natasha afterwards and get on our mailing list, and then you will get lots of email from us. So, it is really a privilege for me today to introduce our speaker, Frances Fox Piven. If I gave her a proper introduction, we would run out of time before she even got a chance to speak. So I'm just going to try to hit a few highlights, although I think many of you are here specifically because you know a lot about her already. But she has been, she's one of the most distinguished social scientists in the United States. She's been writing about social welfare policy and poor people's movements for several decades. Some of her most well-known books are Regulating the Poor from 1971, Poor People's Movements from 1977, The Breaking of the American Social Compact in 1997. Recently, she's talked a lot about political representation and of poor and working class people, and wrote a book called Why Americans Don't Vote in 1998, and then another one, Why Americans Still Don't Vote and Why Politicians Want It That Way in 2000. She's had about every award that you can get, Guggenheim's and Fulbright fellowships. And she provides a lot of service to the academic profession. She's been the president of the American Sociological Association and also a vice president of the American Political Science Association. So she bridges several academic worlds, but she also bridges the world of academics and social activism. She has been very active in not just writing and researching about the policy, but actually affecting policy. She was one of the founders of the National Welfare Rights Organization, which was a very historically important organization in social policy, and that was instrumental in the creation of the Supplemental Security Income Program, or SSI. She later founded the Human Service Employees Registration and Voter Education Campaign, which if you put the acronym together is Human Serve. And that organization championed another very important piece of legislation, which was the National Voter Registration Act of 1993, which you may have heard of as the Voter Bill. So she's also won the Elliott Black Award from the American Ethical Union for her lifelong commitment to create a society of peace and justice. And I could read many more of these awards, but I'd rather hear our guest, Frances Fox Piven, talk, so let's welcome her.
Thank you, Paul. I know you all came here. Can you hear me well? You all came here for a discussion on poverty, but probably you're wondering first what happened to my face. Well, you know, I'm pretty combative. and you should see the other guy. Well, you're all policy experts. And therefore, you all know that we're at a moment in American political development when poverty, inequality generally, is on the rise. The rich are getting richer, and the poor are getting poorer, and there are more and more poor people over time. That has gradually been the case since the 1970s. And this is distinctive to our country. It's not true in other rich countries. There, the poverty problem has been more or less contained, grappled with. So what do we as policy experts have to offer to interpreting this problem? I think you'll probably agree with me that the policy approaches of the last few decades, I'd say the last three decades, have emphasized scrutiny of the poor themselves. What is it about those people that accounts for why they are poor? That's our public policy approach. And we have all sorts of ideas. We identify the attitudes or the habits of life of poor people. The women are too young when they have too many babies, for example, or they're not serious about school, or their parents don't encourage them to be serious about school, or they are tempted into substance abuse or even criminal behavior. We have all sorts of ideas about those people. What is it about those people? And we do lots of studies, empirical studies, correlation analyses, in which we correlate childbearing with poverty, educational attainment with poverty. You don't need me to tell you about that. But you also all know, we all know, that correlations don't disentangle causes and effects. So no matter how much we repeat or the studies which show that early childbearing is correlated with poverty and welfare use and this and that, we can't, from just those correlations, figure out really what's going on, what's causing what in our society. In order to try to understand, I think we have to step back from these particular habits and characteristics and attitudes of the poor. We have to step back to try to untangle what it is about the political economy of the United States in the 20th and 21st centuries that is responsible not only for the persistence of poverty, but for its increase. And I'm going to offer you a perspective. I think our awareness of the poverty problem, you know, there was a time in the history of almost all societies that are now rich societies when poverty was commonplace, a majority phenomenon, people expected to be poor. But poverty doesn't emerge as a problem in that context. It emerges in the United States as a problem, I would say really in the 1930s, when in the wake of an economic collapse, a depression that begins, there are no chairs. Somebody sit on the table. Before the windows. I see a chair over there.
Good night,
Oh, you're planning to leave if it isn't. Poverty emerges, I think, particularly for academics and public policy experts. Poverty emerges as a problem of which we are keenly conscious in the 1930s in the wake of the huge economic collapse, which we know is the Great Depression. The Great Depression produces first a stock market collapse and then rapidly rising unemployment to levels of 25%, a third of the population. Those who are still working face wage slashes. And, of course, this has convulsive effects for the society, including all sorts of social problems, social trauma, and it also produces political convulsions, political change. The first political change is what we know as the Great Electoral Realignment of 1932. The electoral system, which had been divided between two one-party systems, the Democrats in the South, the Republicans in the North. There was a lot of switching and upset as a result of economic hardship. And miraculously, the Democrats, which had been consigned to a kind of minority status after the Civil War, the Democrats won the election of 1932 with FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as their standard bearer, and with a rhetorical line scolding the economic royalists that had brought about this debacle. Although he had the same platform that the Democrats had had in 1924 and 1928. So he was a little bit like Barack Obama, you know? Terrific campaign rhetoric. And then governance is a little bit of a disappointment. But it wasn't just the election. What also began to emerge as early as 1930-31 is a kind of huge variegated protest movement. It began kind of small in the big cities among people who were hungry. What do hungry people do at such a kind of movement moment? Well, actually, they looted food stores. Or when they were threatened with evictions, crowds formed and didn't let the bailiffs evict families. Or in rural areas, crowds formed and didn't permit the sheriff to sell off the farm, threatened rather to string up the sheriff if the auction went forward. And with the other farmers in control of the auction, the farmer could buy back his farm for a nickel. Well, and then the workers' movement emerged. It came a little bit later. It came after, and this is very instructive, very important for us all, because we're always waiting and wondering, is there a movement afoot, or are people just quiet? Are people just resigned? Are they afraid of the Republicans, of the Tea Party, of the Koch brothers? Or maybe something is happening, maybe the fast food workers, maybe Black Friday Walmart actions. There were 1,500 in the country, we know. Maybe Occupy. We never know for sure. Well, in 1932, let me tell you, I'm saying a movement was already emerging, but in 1932, all the journalists were saying, nothing is happening in this country. I'm going back to cultivate my garden. That's a quote from the New Yorker magazine. But this combination of electoral upset, electoral change, and movement in the streets and in the farm and in the factories, because the great strikes began in 1934, 35, 36, the sit-down strikes, had an enormous effect on American public policy. You know, FDR used to say, he said this several times actually, when delegations would come to complain to him, as they no doubt come to complain to Barack Obama, he would say to them, you're right, I agree with you, now go back and make me do it. Well, they did. They went back and they made him do it. And the consequence was that beginning really in 1935, we developed in the United States, in the Congress of the United States, with the President's eventual endorsement, not easily, but eventual, we developed the skeleton of an advanced welfare state. The Social Security Act, which provided pensions for the old and the disabled, federal support for aid to the blind, the disabled, and the orphan, the Wages and Standards Act of 1937. We developed a framework for labor rights under the National Labor Relations Act and the National Labor, which established the National Labor Relations Board. It looked very good. We developed the very important regulation of finance, which was ultimately only upset, overturned in the last decade or so. So the United States became, reluctantly maybe a little weaker, a laggard, but nevertheless became part of the family of capitalist welfare states.